Welcome, this is John Phelps with Biblical Truth and History and Prophecy, coming to you this beautiful day of the 23rd of July, 2008. Well, today we have with us a personal friend and an excellent author. He has written a most excellent book that I heartily recommend and encourage those of you to get his book. And this book is titled The Transformation of the Republic, and the Origins of the Religious Hijacking of the American Government, the Truth Behind the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And it's in the second edition, and the author with us today is C.T. Wilcox. So, Chuck, I want to welcome you today, and thank you for coming on the broadcast. And I would love to talk with you about your book, The Lincoln Assassination, and whatever else you'd like to talk about.
Sure. Well, thank you very much, Eric, and good afternoon to all your listeners.
Well, Chuck, it's I've known you for a couple of years now, and I have your first edition, but you sent me the second edition, and it's just wonderful. You have lots of good pictures in there, lots of good old cartoons on the papacy and what they seek to do. You have the pictures of General Thomas Harris, Brigadier General Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And, tell me, to begin with, let's go into why you wrote the book. What led you to do this?
What led me to do it was the fact that it has never been taught properly. I have cousins in the States. I haven't seen them in a long time, since the 1970s. But when we were kids and we got to talking, I was able to find out certain things, because our education system here is vastly different from the education system there, even at that time.
And where do you live now, Chuck, just for the listeners?
Right now I live in Calgary, Alberta. At the time I was living in southern Ontario, just outside of Toronto. And they would come up and visit, and we had a property up in about 4 hours drive north of Toronto. It was in the middle of the woods and that, and they would come up in the summertime, and we would, spend a few weeks together and that. But we would discuss geography and history and things like this, like things that just aren't taught. These are subjects that just weren't taught in the high schools in the States at that time. When I was talking like a Delta-winged bomber, like the Vulcan bomber, which was brand new at that time anyway, that the Brits had just made, it was described as a Delta wing bomber, and they didn't even know what a Delta was. And they said, well, like the Delta of the Mississippi or the Delta of the Nile, or they just blank stares. They said the only Delta they knew was like Delta Airlines.
American education.
But the history was just as bad. They weren't mm-hmm. taught proper history. And I kind of stumbled upon a few things a few years later, and knowing that the U.S. people are not taught properly their own history, I felt compelled to do this. And it wasn't until recently that I was able to get a hold of a cache of documents from the Chiniki family. There's a gentleman in Elliott Lake right now that has possession of all that stuff, but he was looking to seek possession of it almost at the same time as I was trying to find out what was out there as well. And I got a hold of a professor, Lougheed, at McGill University in Montreal. And he gave me the name of the gentleman that now has control of this material. But at that time, the relative, her name was Laura Lefebvre. She was like in her 80s and that. She was very sick, ready to go into a nursing home. I think she's since passed away. But I talked to her on two or three separate occasions, asking her if I could get the rights to publish much of the material that she had in her possession. And so we worked it out between the three of us, and I was able to do that. and then I was a lot of money spent researching things out of the U.S. archives in Washington and the Library of Congress, on and on. It's a lot of different sources. It took a lot of time and money in that, but some of the compelling stuff was in the hands of the Chiniki family, and I felt it just this had to be out. Historians don't even know that this material exists.
So now, for the sake of the listeners, who was Charles Chiniki, and thus the significance of the Chiniki family?
Okay, Charles Chiniki was a Roman Catholic priest who was transferred from Kamouraska, Quebec, to Illinois to establish a colony there, and he founded the town of St. Anne, Illinois, and that. He was honored by the papacy and by the Quebec government and by the Canadian government for his work in temperance. During his lifetime, well, in his early life anyway, there was
temperance
a big problem.
Temperance being what now?
Temperance?
Yes.
There is a lot of drinking going on.
So he was called Charles Chiniki was known as the Apostle of Temperance, is that correct?
That's right. Okay. That's right. And what he did, when he was growing up, the ratio of bars to schools was something like 9-1, right? And he wanted to reverse that ratio, which he eventually did. And so that's why he was called the Apostle Temperance of Canada. Right. So, yeah, what he did, he established schools everywhere. And
So Charles Chiniki was basically a pretty honest priest, a pretty decent fellow, mm-hmm. in wanting to do good and doing away with the rum trade and getting rid of the bars and so on in Canada, correct?
Not necessarily. Well, I suppose getting rid of them, but more. He wanted more education than drinking, and there was an awful lot of that going on at the time. Okay. I don't know if at the time he wanted to completely eradicate the bars, probably, but he was more focused on establishing the schools more than anything else, I think, and making sure that drunkenness did not become such an institution. In the area where he was living, anyway, but yeah, he was raised with the Bible. Then he went to become a priest, and I guess right from the beginning he had a big problem comparing what his church was teaching him and what the Bible was saying, and things got so bad. I guess when he went to Chicago, he tried to make changes because all of the Irish priests were all hard drinking. And they were into a lot of immorality, and he tried to stop that in his own way. And they decided to railroad. They cooked up a plan to have him criminally charged with rape. And excuse me, he got a lawyer. Abraham Lincoln actually defended him in one of the more remarkable court cases of Lincoln's legal profession, and it was through that court case that they became very close friends. And Charles Chiniki eventually left the church. He just got so disgusted, but at the same time he kept up his friendship with Abraham Lincoln. And when then Mr. Lincoln went to become president, would stay in contact with him, going to Washington at least once during each year of his administration. He'd kind of hang around for a couple of weeks. And filling Lincoln in on what was going on, what the church was doing in order to try to destroy the everything that the U.S. was founded on, mm-hmm. like separation of church and state, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, freedom of association, all these freedoms that the United States was founded on, Rome wanted to completely overturn. They wanted to set up basically an autocracy based on the Catholic autocracies of Europe. They wanted to bring the United States back under monarchical rule.
If I might add here, when Lincoln had successfully defended Chiniki and the priest had fled town, after Lincoln was thundering against the papacy and what Bishop O'Regan sought to do against Chiniquy. Chiniquy was found crying after the trial, and Lincoln went up to Chiniquy and asked him, "Father Chiniquy, what's the problem? Your enemies have fled. The jury has found you not guilty. Why do you weep?" And Chiniquy said, "I don't weep for myself, Mr. Lincoln. I weep for you. Because there was no less than 11 Jesuits in that courtroom that had the sentence of death on their faces." And Lincoln thought a few minutes and he said, "Well, the price will be $50 for defense." And he says, "Remember that I know that the Jesuits never forget nor forsake. And it's not how a man dies, but where he dies. And that death should be at the post of duty and honor." So this tremendously endeared Charles Chiniquy to Lincoln. And as you mentioned, Chiniquy would go yearly to visit Lincoln when he was president and warn him of the priest's conspiracy to assassinate him someday.
Yeah. Well, he said, you know, "They will kill you. And let me tell you this, if I were in their place and they were in mine, it would be my sole sworn duty to take your life myself or find a man
Absolutely.
To do it."
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened. But some of these sworn statements, though, that I was able to get, like I could, they're blunt. One was from Reverend Conwell, and these are sworn statements from priests that were in Minnesota, in the middle of nowhere, Minnesota. There was no rail, no telegraph for like 80 or 100 miles, and they were talking about Lincoln's assassination. Hours, I guess, when these two priests rolled in to St. Cloud, Minnesota, and St. Joseph, Minnesota, hours before it actually happened in Washington. And one of the sworn statements says that they were talking about it on the Wednesday previous to the Friday of the assassination. This is like several days ahead of time. So the question then becomes, well, how on earth would they know, to the point that they're bragging about it, by the way, because they were so sure that this was going to come down that they couldn't help but brag about it days before it actually happened.
Well, their international system of espionage via the confessional and their special ways of communication, either by the telegraph or Pony Express or other priests, because they were building their network out into the Midwest at this time. Pierre de Schmitt was the most powerful Jesuit in the Midwest, and he had a host of connections from the Masons to the Mormons to whatever, and so it would be very easy for them to be informed of it a week ahead of time, and thus proving the Rome's papal conspiracy in the assassination of Lincoln.
Right. But, and the thing was that, like, historians have no idea that these sworn statements even exist. But I thought, well, you know, this has to be brought out.
Wonderful. So let me get this right. You, as a Canadian, felt compassion and mercy upon us poor, ignorant Americans, since we've been taught nothing, to bring forth the truth about the assassination of probably our foremost president since Washington. Can that be safely said? Chuck.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm
being facetious. I'm glad you did do this, because I can think of very few historians or even preachers that would tell us this. So, again, as an American, I want to thank you for writing your book and helping me understand my history, that only one college professor ever had the desire to teach me. The rest were completely blank on it. So thank you.
Yeah, it's what can you do? I know. I like history, though, and I thought this was like such a compelling story, and it hasn't been like and especially after talking with my relatives and that in the States, they're going, all they're taught is that, you know, Booth, and I go, well, there were other people that were hung and sent to jail. What about all them? You know. Mm-hmm. All you get is like blank stares in response.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, tell us about some of those people, Chuck. Tell us about the conspiracy that was plotted against the assassination of Lincoln. Tell us who was involved and And then we'll talk about General Harris, if you'd like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dear. So where do you want to go? You have to go all the way back to 1820. It's quite an involved thing to get up to the point where Booth and John Surratt and Atzerodt and Harold and all those guys were kind of brought together in the house of John Surratt under the control of the priest, the main priest, I guess, was Bernard Wiggett.
Yes.
And then there was there were a number of them, and almost all of the conspirators, according to Brigadier General Harris, who is a member of the Assassination Tribunal, tried the assassins. He says that the majority of these players were all fanatical Romanists, and they were being led by the nose by their priests. It's just as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. And we know that John Wilkes Booth was brought into the Roman Catholic Church by Archbishop Spalding there in Washington 3 weeks before the assassination.
Mm-hmm.
So really, in fact, they were all Roman Catholics. They were all serving the papacy. Jesuit Bernardine F. Wiggett oversaw it all. And by the way, Georgetown University has an extant library on the assassination and the Bernardine F. Wiggett papers for those of you who wish to review it even further. But indeed, tell us about the assassination and the military tribunal there, which General Harris was a part of.
How do you mean the assassination? Like, they got together, they decided what they were going to do. You know, they each had their own roles. John Surratt, he was like one of the main ringleaders, by the way, and his name is rarely ever mentioned in history. And he was like he's just a kid, but are you like, 19 years old and that? But
yes.
I mean, he's kind of the guy that's bringing all this together, and eventually was went to the Vatican, became a member of the Papal Guard, and you've got the Pope defending. Protecting Surratt and Surratt protecting the Pope is quite the symbiotic relationship there after the assassination.
Mm-hmm. Eric John Phelps, back again with Biblical Truth in History and Prophecy with our guest today, Charles Wilcox, reviewing his work, Transformation of the Republic, concerning Rome's hand, design, and purpose behind the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, a secret that's been kept from us, the American people, through academia, through our public schools, because there can be nothing detrimental ever said about the papacy. Okay, Chuck, I'd like you now to go into what happened to Surratt after the assassination. I know he was calling time outside Ford's Theater, but can you trace his steps and where he went and ultimately what happened to him, please?
Yeah, sure. Before I do that, though, may I give my website?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, it's ctwilcox.com. That's W-I-L-C-O-X. And I've got a bunch of very interesting stuff on there. A couple of books that Samuel Morse had written, and just a lot of things that will bring things into a modern-day perspective as well. You can also, there's a link there for Lulu, and you can order the book through there if you set up an account with Lulu. Or you can just send payment to a P.O. box that I have at the bottom of the homepage. That's ctwilcox.com. Okay, John Surratt, after the assassination.
Do you have a phone number, Charles, if people might want to call you? Or do you
not presently, no.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't. But they can email me, cwilcox@telus.net. That's TELUS.net.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
Okay, please continue.
Yeah, okay. John Surratt, after the assassination, decided to hightail it to a little town outside of Montreal called Trois-Rivières, and he was harbored there. Actually, there was a couple of priests there. LaPierre and Bourget. That were waiting for him. They had already gotten advance notice that he was on his way. And this is at a time right now that the United States has, like, one of the greatest manhunts in U.S. history is on for this guy.
Right.
You know, so what does he do? He goes to Montreal, and he's squirreled away for the better part of a half a year by these two priests. And then from there, he's kind of in disguise. He's put on a ship to Liverpool, and he's sent to Liverpool to a Roman Catholic clearinghouse, I guess. It's a place where the all the priests of Europe and that, when they were coming through over to this side of the ocean, would come through this one place in Liverpool and vice versa, right? So it was a way station, as it were. So Surratt kind of sat there for a while, got money sent to him to finance his way to Italy. When he gets to Italy, he becomes a member of the Papal Zouaves, like the Papal Guards, mm-hmm. under the name of John Watson.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is now, protecting the Pope, basically, and the Pope is protecting him. The Pope, knowing full well that, you know, the United States is just livid and wanting to get this guy back, right? But there's no extradition treaty.
Right.
So,
That's typical of a popish assassination, that the assassins are taken out of the country and sent to a place where there's no extradition. We see the very same thing happening with the Kennedy assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Please continue.
Sure. So now it's getting to the point where the church is thinking, well, if we don't do something to kind of placate the United States government, then we're going to lose a lot of like church property and that, and we can't have that. So what we're going to do is say, okay, we're going to offer him up to you, right? But under one condition, that he does not face capital punishment. And so the United States well said, fine, okay, we'll accept that, right? So what happens next is they stage an escape for the guy. All of the diplomatic correspondence that I was able to get from the period it was in the U.S. archives and that, is just this great big soap opera of how John Surratt escaped and Rome says, well, he escaped, too bad, so sad, there's nothing we can do about it now, right? And he was given advance warning, and he was helped, basically, to escape. So the United States, through one of their contacts in Rome, a guy that says, well, I've seen what's going on, and I don't want to have any part of it anymore. I want to kind of turn state's evidence and help you guys out, right? They find out that John Surratt is now working his way to Alexandria, Egypt. So the U.S. government gets a hold of a gunboat called the Sotara that's kind of kicking around the Mediterranean, and they send this boat down to Alexandria to meet up with the ship that Surratt is on, under the name of John Watson, and they get there like a day before, and they're waiting for him, and here he is coming down the gangplank, and the federal official says, excuse me, but I believe you're John Surratt. And he said, oh, no, my name's John Watson. He said, well, no, I don't think so. So they arrested him, and they brought him back to face trial, and they had a trial.
Let me just interrupt one thing here, Chuck. The gentleman who told as to the location of Watson was Louis Welchman, correct?
Louis Weichmann. Weichmann was a friend of Surratt's. Right, so there was that, yeah, but there was another guy who was a member of the Zouaves at the same time, and I can't recall his name offhand, but his life was in danger because he had spoken to the U.S. government
yes.
about it.
They nearly wrecked Weichmann's life.
Oh, here it is. Henri Sainte-Marie was the name of the person in Rome. He was a member of the Vatican Guard as well, and he said he wanted to help the United States out. And when his name was brought up over in Europe, all of a sudden Henri Sainte-Marie is now persona non grata, and people are trying to kill him. you know, for saying that John Watson is actually John Surratt. So he was given protection by the U.S. government and brought back to testify against Surratt when Surratt came when the trial took place.
And one more thing, did not President Johnson, that Freemason whose daughter was educated by priests in a convent, did he not remove the bounty on Surratt?
He did.
And so here we have high-level Freemasonry working with the Jesuits to keep Surratt from being arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, it's quite the episode. And I think it took a congressional, like an act of Congress to overturn that and get on the ball back again, you know. So anyway, he's brought back to face trial, but where do they have the trial? In Georgetown. Right, so as soon as they get him back to Georgetown, which is like Jesuit Central, right?
Right, Jesuit Central with Georgetown Jesuit University, the capital of America.
Yeah. So they're able, from there, they said, well, we're going to have like a civil trial, a civil criminal trial. But with the civil, the difference between what happened with the original Lincoln conspirators and that, they came in front of a military tribunal. Now, the Catholic Church was livid over that because they could not influence a military tribunal. However, they could influence a civil criminal proceeding, right? They could do that in a number of ways. One of the ways they tried was by messing with the jury pool. And they would try to make sure that they had enough Romanists stacked on the jury so that they could play to religious prejudices. And one of the first things that Surratt's lawyers, Bradley, do is they play the religious card and then try to say, well, it's religious discrimination and all this stuff, which is like completely out to lunch. The bottom line throughout that entire trial was that he got off on a hung jury. The jury could not agree because it had been tweaked by the church. So you've got a hung jury, and so they tried to bring him back for trial a second time, and there was a hung jury a second time as well because the jury could not agree on a guilty verdict. And then he was let go, and he lived to a ripe old age, and, you know,
ripe old age of 72. He died in 1916 of a Boston as an auditor of a Boston steamship corporation. And when that spiritual bastard had his funeral, he was given a high requiem mass, which are usually only given to priests or for someone who has greatly benefited and served the Pope of Rome.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's quite the piece of history there. But, yeah, I mean, it's like the Vatican, I mean, they were playing both sides of the fence, though, during the entire Civil War. You know, they had openly acknowledged the legitimacy of the Confederacy. And when that happened, right after Gettysburg, the 72% of the Irish contingent in the Union Army bolted. They defected to the ranks of the South. 72%, 140 some odd thousand Irish Catholics decided to defect from the ranks of the Union Army to help out the Confederacy. When that letter by the Pope was published in all of the newspapers,
that was in September, I believe, of 1863, wasn't it? September?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Okay, it was after Gettysburg, and I want to make a few comments here. Number one, the Vatican wanted to destroy the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant South. Remember, all the Irish Catholics were primarily settled in the north, in the northern cities, because the Irish Catholics hated the blacks, and they didn't want anything to do with them. So they were primarily settled in the northern cities, thus thereby dividing the country geographically, being more Protestant, being more Catholic in the north than in the south. And after they started the war with that Roman Catholic Freemason Beauregard, when he fired on Fort Sumter, the Jesuits were were working, even though they were controlling Jefferson Davis and Judah Benjamin, the Secretary of State there, and also Robert E. Lee, for that matter, because we know Robert E. Lee refused to allow the great Protestant, Presbyterian, Calvinist Stonewall Jackson from defeating the Yankee Army four times. He forbade him to defeat the Yankee Army. And so after Jackson is killed, then at Chancellorsville, we shortly thereafter have Gettysburg, where Lee and Longstreet throw the battle, deliberately lose, and then the Jesuits use Meade to not pursue Lee. They incite the riots in New York City against the blacks and the draft rats, I believe, and that draws up, what, one-third of Meade's army, so that gives Lee a chance to escape. And why would the Vatican want Lee to escape? So that it could be a war of annihilation against the Protestants of the South. And that's exactly what it happened to be continuing for nearly 2 years after that. But after the Gettysburg lost to the South, then the Pope openly sides with the South. Prior to that, he never would have, because he wanted the South to lose, and on the ruins and wreck of the Republic, they would erect this horrible 14th Amendment, corporate fascist, socialist, communist American empire. So that is my understanding of it, and thus, as you said, they're playing both sides. The Jesuits are radical abolitionists in the North, as well as radical secessionists in the South.
Right, they were playing both sides of the fence. It was, and ultimately so that the Rome could benefit in the end. But at the same time all of this is going on, you have the emperors of Europe trying to do their nasty business. I was able to get material from the Austrian archives, letters by Pope, not Pope, but King Leopold I, letters to his son, was it? Well, anyway, Maximilian.
Maximilian.
Yeah. And what happened was, you've got Napoleon fighting Britain, Napoleon III, and Maximilian in Mexico. Napoleon sends over 15,000 crack French troops to line up on the Mexican side of the Rio Grande. Under the authority of Maximilian. The purpose of that was that the Vatican had hoped that the South would take Gettysburg, and then once that happened, the French army that was based in Mexico would move up and join forces with the Confederacy and march on Washington in a pincer movement, and then take over the country from there. And then by stages, establish monarchical rule in North America the way they figured it was intended to begin with before the break with Britain. Right? They figured that, well, the only way that we can operate as a religion is to operate through an autocracy. That's the best way. It takes one autocrat to deal with another autocrat. So this is what they were hoping to establish. Ultimate, and they're still hoping for it. I mean, look what's happening now.
Sure.
Okay. You know, I mean, you've got basically an autocracy in the making now with the Patriot Acts and all these freedoms going down the tank. It's mm-hmm. kind of, you know.
The Patriot Act, authored by the Jesuits of Georgetown through Viet Dinh.
And, right, so it hasn't, nothing's really changed on that respect.
Semper Edom, always the same.
Yeah, the other thing that the Vatican was doing was using the immigration policies of the United States to bolster their own ranks in order to use the concept of the vote against the country, right? Like, to outnumber the vote, basically, and then tell their parishioners, like, through their priests, and I've got, like, newspaper articles of the period that discusses this in detail, of how the priests, under the orders of the Pope, would tell the parishioners to vote for this person or vote for that person because they're Catholic and because
Absolutely.
they promote church interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so this
Absolutely.
Is what they were doing. Yeah, this is what they were doing with the bolstering the huge immigrant. Now they're doing the same thing with the Mexicans today.
That's right.
You've got
That's right.
You've got
That's
Mahoney.
Right. That's excuse me.
Mm-hmm. You've got Cardinal Mahoney, or Archbishop, or whatever he is, bragging about the fact that he can control the votes of 5 million people in L.A.
Mm-hmm. You know, see, and that ought to make every Californian livid. That ought to make every Californian furious.
Yeah. And these are things that Samuel Morse wrote about way back in 1835. He wrote two books, actually. One is called Foreign Conspiracy Against the Liberties of the United States. And then there was another book that I didn't know existed until just recently called, I've got it up on my website on the Sam Morse page. It discusses the immigration situation and how it's being used by the church to destroy the liberties of the U.S. So the things that he talked about then in 1835 are happening right now. I thought, my God, it's like nothing's changed, you know. And these are the actual books that were scanned and then turned into PDF. And they're up there for free. Anybody that, if they want to read what Samuel Morse had to say at the time, there for everyone.
So you have the Foreign Conspiracy Against the Liberties of the People of the United States. You have that up there scanned for free?
Yep.
Well, praise the Lord. And I greatly commend you for this and recommend the listeners to go to your website, download that, because Samuel Morse was the father of Morse code. He was viciously beaten in Italy when he refused to bow to the host. And this is a masterpiece work. It shows the power of the Jesuits, their designs, the Loophole Foundation, and a host of other things. So please go to it and download it for free after you have ordered C.T. Wilcox's book. So, Chuck, we only have a few more minutes left, so please tell the listeners how to get your wonderful book, A Transformation of the Republic, The Origins of the Religious Hijacking of the American Government, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Okay, it's ctwilcox.com. That's ctwilcox.com. And there's a link there for Lulu. You have to, if you want to order the book from Lulu, you have to set up an account with them. And then you can buy it there. There's two versions. There's the original paperback version, which is about 370 some odd pages, and then there's a new second edition hardcover, 660 pages. And then on the website as well, I've got Imminent Dangers Against the Free Institutions of the United States. That's the second book that Samuel Morse wrote, by the way. I have period cartoons, a lot of current events articles, and various other things up there that make a good a research tool if you want to research further about what's going on in this day and age. Anyway, I keep adding to it periodically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Chuck, it's been a pleasure to have you on today, and I want to invite you back anytime you want to come back. Just give me a call, and I will have you back whenever you want to come back. And it's very informative. You've done a wonderful job. You have done a great job on thoroughly going through the assassination of Lincoln. And it's my prayer that the listeners would realize that they have not only assassinated Kennedy, but they've assassinated Lincoln and a few others. To the end that we might resist not only the spiritual power of the Pope, but also his temple power.
Mm-hmm.
So, Chuck, thank you for coming on the broadcast today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, this is Brother Eric John Phelps of Biblical Truth and History and Prophecy, coming to you today with C.T. Wilcox, reviewing his great work, The Transformation of the Republic, full of great pictures. And I don't know how you folks feel, but I love a book with pictures. That just makes it come alive. And so I heartily recommend it. Please purchase it. Keep it in your library as a resource work to teach your family, your children, your grandchildren, your parents, your grandparents. Spread this information because it's true and it's founded in right history that is now free for the taking and reading.